Effectively, the group that met at the Chicago Hilton had come up with a series of tools. To be sure, the tools were crude, but they were the first real attempt made in the heat of a political campaign to turn down the volume on racial bias. As it turned out, none of the ads were aired before the 2008 election because the financial meltdown in the weeks before the election sent potential funders scurrying for cover. Powell's team also found that many of the attack ads planned against Obama were never aired for the same reason. But the research showed that in order to combat conscious and explicit bias, people who shout racist things at rallies and put up "Vote Right, Vote White" signs, ads of children playing together on a team, or black and white families doing identical things, are effective. To combat outright hatred, you want to call people to their better angels, and hope the lump in their throats can overcome the bile in their hearts. But when it comes to unconscious bias, the grey monster lurking beneath the surface in a large number of voters, you need different tools. The "I Am an American" ad acknowledged the way many voters felt about Obama. Without telling them that they were wrong, it suggested an alternative route to channel their feelings. "We are going back to the future, to Freud," Weston told me. "There really is this dissociation," he spoke about, "between the conscious and the unconscious, but we now have ways of measuring it. How do you detoxify race in elections so people cannot run the "Call Me, Harold" ad, or the "Kwame Kilpatrick" ad, or the "Willie Horton" ad? If you are vulnerable to such attacks, you have to measure both conscious and unconscious attitudes and develop strategies that address both. I found the ads fascinating, but also disturbing, in that they sometimes placed what made political sense at odds with what made ethical sense. Which version of the "All God's Children" ad would you have chosen if you were a political consultant? You wouldn't have chosen the ad showing the darker-skinned black dad, because Weston's data demonstrated that it worked less well at persuading white voters than the ad that showed only the lighter-skinned black dad. In order to be politically effective, to get voters to support your candidate, you had to choose the ad that went along with people's unconscious biases against darker-skinned black men. The same went for the "I Am an American" ad. When people spread racist lies about a black candidate, the obvious response was righteous indignation, but the more effective response was apparently to approach the problem sideways, to tell voters that the way they felt was understandable, but to ask them to take a chance on the candidate. Racist beliefs, in other words, were best left unchallenged if you wanted to persuade someone to vote for your candidate. I started to understand why Obama's approach had succeeded where so many other black politicians had failed. His campaign's conscious decision not to cry foul, not to voice the righteous indignation to which he was surely entitled, was the only way he could win. I asked Celinda Lake about this after the election. She acknowledged that there was a tension between fighting stereotypes and trying to get a candidate elected, but she pointed out that if getting Obama into the White House involved making some compromises, it was also the case that Obama's election promised to reduce racism in the United States as nothing else could. The hidden brain learns through blind repetition, and Obama's election meant the country and the world would spend the next several years being bombarded with counter-stereotypical messages about a very smart, articulate, and charismatic black man who happened to be the most powerful person on the planet. "Having worked for a number of African-American candidates," Lake said, "I don't care if I get someone elected by appealing to exceptionalism. The idea that that particular black candidate was the exception to the rule, an approach that could reinforce stereotypes. I would like to end racism, but I first want to get Barack Obama elected." Lake told me that David Axelrod, the political mastermind behind the Obama campaign, had helped a number of African-American candidates get elected by relentlessly not focusing on trying to change people's underlying views about race and gender. when getting Carol Moseley Braun elected to the Senate, for example, pollsters once found that having Braun stand up and speak directly into the camera for an ad prompted voters to feel she was in their face, in a way they did not feel when a white man delivered exactly the same lines. It was clearly sexist and racist, and the path of righteous indignation might have said, "The hell with such biases. Have Braun speak directly into the camera." But Axelrod, whose job it was to get Braun elected, suggested she sit behind a table and speak her lines. Voters immediately found the message more acceptable. I don't know how to resolve the imperative of righteous indignation with the imperative to get your candidate elected. If the techniques of political consultants are sometimes icky, it should also be said that righteous indignation never got a black man elected president. It was Axelrod and Obama who found a way to make King's dream come true, by sidestepping controversy and turning down the temperature on race. Unfairness seems written into the DNA of politics, because voters consciously and unconsciously care about a host of factors that candidates cannot control. Political consultants will always try to find ways to win with the cards they are dealt, and that can mean exploiting both legitimate strengths and unfair advantages. Obama was clearly a gifted candidate. His calm, even-tempered style was a matter of natural inclination, and his adoration of his daughters was obviously sincere. Being a calm person does not automatically mean someone will make a good president, but the trait served Obama well in that a hot-tempered nature might have evoked the dreaded trope of the angry black man. Obama's visible love for his children helped disable unconscious stereotypes that link black men with disinterested fatherhood. Obama also happened to be biracial, and he used his links to whiteness to his advantage. Barack Obama had light-colored skin, and that made a big difference, Drew Weston said quietly after the election, during a conference call that brought everyone from the Chicago meeting up to speed on what the research had found. Had he looked like Kwame Kilpatrick, it is not at all clear to me that he could have made it. Chapter 10. The Telescope Effect, Lost Dogs and Genocide. The ideas in this book have been organized in concentric circles, where successive chapters have illustrated how the hidden brain influences our lives from very small issues to very large issues. We have examined the effects of the hidden brain among children and in intimate relationships, in disasters and in suicide terrorism, in the criminal justice system and in politics. I decided to devote the final chapter of the book to the subject of numbers. It sounds esoteric, but it is not. Consciously and unconsciously, the way we think about numbers influences the most important decisions we make as human beings. Edward Shinnick was the head of internal affairs at the police department in Jersey City. He was married with two children, a respected figure in his northern New Jersey community. Shinnick loved being a cop, but was not entirely happy at internal affairs. Few cops enjoy keeping an eye on their fellow officers, but Shinnick was articulate and verbal. When he was stressed at work, he talked about it at home with his wife, Michelle, and with other friends. He was a cop's cop, a confidant to many fellow officers. He counseled colleagues through emotional upheavals and marital problems. He considered himself on police duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He carried his gun wherever he went. He never drank. He felt he had no right to be under the effect of alcohol when he was armed. In May 2008, Shinnick put in his papers and retired. He was 52 years old. On May 28th, a Wednesday, Shinnick visited his mother, who was in a nursing home. When he left, he gave a nurse his new cell phone number. He had lunch with an old buddy, a retired police lieutenant. Shinnick did not come home that afternoon or that evening. It was not like him to be late and not call, but his wife, Michelle, figured that he had probably gone back to the police department to meet some friends. She called around, but no one had seen Shinnick. By 9 o'clock in the evening, at the urging of the police, Michelle filed a missing persons report. She went online and found that Shinnick had made a cash withdrawal from an ATM machine in Wyckoff, a short distance northwest of their home. Shinnick had gone to Wyckoff and then had kept driving. He went all the way to Pennsylvania, to a comfort inn that he and Michelle stayed in from time to time. Michelle's cousin stayed in the Poconos, and whenever the Shinnicks drove back from a visit, they stayed at the motel. The comfort inn allowed dogs, and the Shinnicks were dog people. Ed Shinnick removed his easy pass from his car before he went on his trip. He knew Michelle and his cop buddies would try to trace the car using the pass, and he did not want to be tracked down. He checked into a room at the motel. Ed Shinnick had two guns with him, including his police service revolver. Inside the motel room, he aimed one weapon at his heart and the other at his head. He pulled both triggers simultaneously. A cleaning lady found his dead body. Michelle Shinnick found the news incomprehensible. She pieced together the events of Ed Shinnick's last day. Why would a man planning to kill himself leave his new cell phone number at his mother's nursing home? The retired police lieutenant whom Shinnick had met for lunch was someone who used to teach cops about stress and the risk of suicide. Michelle talked with him, and he told her that there had been no sign that Shinnick was contemplating suicide. If you were to make a list of the people most unlikely to complete the act of suicide, Michelle Shinnick told me, my husband's name would be number one. Whenever someone takes their own life, our automatic response is to ask what was going on in their life. Taking one's life seems profoundly irrational, and we always look for evidence of mental disorder and stress, marital unhappiness, or a fall from grace. Shinnick had his share of troubles. He was not entirely happy at Internal Affairs, but he had just retired. Being a cop was certainly stressful. Shinnick had been standing at the harbor at Liberty State Park when the September 11th attacks took place. He saw the second plane hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center, and he helped count the dead in the days that followed. Shinnick had once been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder after his car got stuck on some tracks. A train rammed his vehicle, and Shinnick was in and out of work the following year as he recovered from injuries. That was in 1993, 15 years before he took his life. By the time of his death in 2008, the PTSD diagnosis had long faded from everyone's memory. On the plus side, Shinnick was a respected member of his community and a successful cop. He had a wonderful marriage and family. He had deep religious faith. Many people with much less going for them endure more difficult challenges and never contemplate suicide. Michelle Shinnick told me that four other police officers in the local area had taken their lives in the months after her husband's suicide. It really is an epidemic. That is no exaggeration. Suicide among police officers is underreported. Newspapers and local TV stations do not offer wall-to-wall coverage of police suicides the way they memorialize cops killed on the beat. The different kinds of attention paid to homicide and suicide obscure the fact that there are more than twice as many suicides among police officers in the United States as there are homicides. John Violante, a research professor in the School of Public Health at the State University of New York at Buffalo, has spent years studying suicide among police officers. Contrary to popular notions about the risk of police work, Violante and others have found that the risk of officers taking their own lives vastly dwarfs the risk that they will be killed in action. Drug wars and firefights, muggings, robberies and assaults, murderers, rapists and serial killers collectively pose a much smaller threat to your average cop than the risk that he will put his service revolver to his head and shoot himself. When scientists study epidemics, they don't study individuals. It is true that epidemics preferentially strike the vulnerable. A person with AIDS has a greater risk of catching the flu than a healthy person. But if you want to stop an epidemic, you don't go after individual patients or the idiosyncratic things that place individuals at risk. You go after the common factors behind the epidemic. You look for cures or vaccines and ways to halt the epidemic before it spreads. In the case of malaria, you stop an epidemic by preventing the breeding of mosquitoes. Mosquitoes are the means, the vector, by which malaria is transmitted. You don't destroy the malaria parasite by curbing mosquitoes, but destroying the vector keeps the parasite from infecting people. Mosquito eradication is a more effective way to stop a malaria epidemic than treating individual patients one by one with quinine. The difference between the two approaches, one broad scale and the other individualized, is the central difference between a public health approach to an epidemic and a medical approach. When we probe the mental and emotional antecedents of someone who has committed suicide, we are implicitly pursuing a medical approach. When we tailor interventions to individuals, counseling people who are stressed and asking what is going on in their lives, we are pursuing a medical approach. We are going after the problem of suicide one individual at a time. Every person is different from every other because the constellation of symptoms, risks, and circumstances is different for everyone. But is there another way to think about suicide? To think about it as a public health problem? Is there a kill the mosquitoes to halt malaria approach to suicide? John Violante and other public health experts have asked themselves what it is about police work that places officers at high risk for suicide. The conventional explanation is that police work is stressful. You don't know who lurks behind each corner when you are patrolling a beat, and you have no idea if the driver you pull over for speeding on a beautiful day is a drug dealer packing heat. But Violante, like all good scientists, decided to put his intuitions to the test. He compared the risk of suicide in three stressful professions. He studied 8.5 million death certificates in 28 states to find out the relative risk of suicide among police officers, firefighters, and military personnel. All three lines of work place people at personal risk and involve high stress. All involve unpredictable and long hours that can interfere with family life. Violante found that military personnel and police officers had a far higher risk of suicide than firefighters. Cops turn out to have about 4 times the suicide risk of firefighters. Black cops in the United States have nearly 5 times the suicide risk of black firefighters. White women who are police officers are 12 times more likely to commit suicide than white women who are firefighters. The central difference among cops, military personnel, and firefighters, Violante concluded, is that cops and military personnel carry guns. Nearly all police suicides involve the use of guns. The vast majority are service weapons. Guns don't make people suicidal, but they provide the impulse of suicide with a vector, in exactly the same way that the mosquito provides the malaria parasite with a vector. If cops were to check their guns at police departments when they left work, Violante figured, a substantial number of police suicides might vanish. Large numbers of police officers and their family members are also killed in accidental shootings involving service weapons. When you add together the number of police officers killed in accidents, the number of family members of cops who are killed in accidents, and the number of family members of cops who commit suicide, this pool of victims forms an even larger group than the number of police officers who commit suicide. No one knows exactly how often service weapons are implicated in all these deaths, but it is certain they are used frequently. If officers checked their weapons when they went off duty, it could reduce those deaths too. Violante used to be a cop, and he understands how cops think. He knows the idea would never fly, Police officers such as Ed Shinnick think of themselves as being on call all the time. Even when they are off duty and in civilian attire, cops want to be ready to intervene in emergencies. Newspapers abound with stories of how off-duty police officers halted convenience store robberies because they were carrying their service weapons. Some police departments actually require police officers to carry a gun with them at all times. In Jersey City, Ed Shinnick was required to purchase his weapon. After he retired, the gun belonged to him. Police officers think their biggest risk of getting killed comes from bad guys on the street. Hundreds of books, thousands of movies, and millions of pages of newsprint have been devoted to the general subject of cops and robbers. When was the last time you saw a movie or read a book about a cop committing suicide? Even if such a movie were made, you can bet it would never become the next Die Hard. Our intuitions tell us that cops are primarily at risk of getting killed in the line of duty. As a general rule, movies that contradict our intuitions, even intuitions that are demonstrably false, are movies that few people will care to watch. The data on the relative risks of homicide and suicide are stark. Cops are only the most dramatic example of what happens when people have ready access to handguns. America's long debate about gun control has centered on the conflict between those who feel guns protect them from criminals and those who feel the availability of guns allows criminals to get their hands on weapons. Gun control advocates say that the ready availability of guns in the United States makes gun violence inevitable. Gun enthusiasts say, duh, the bad guys have weapons already and won't turn them in if we tighten gun laws. The only smart thing to do is to keep a gun in your home to defend yourself. Neither side pays much attention to the evidence, which shows that people who have guns in their homes are at a greater risk of being shot and killed than people who do not have guns in their homes. The risk does not come from homicidal maniacs or muggers or rapists. The risk comes from people using their own guns to shoot themselves or their family members. The gun debate in America should not be between those who argue that individuals have a right to protect themselves and those who argue that the interests of society should come first. The issue is whether people who live in homes with guns are safer as a result of owning a gun, and the answer, unequivocally, is no. The combined risk of accidents, suicide, and domestic violence dwarfs the risk of homicide at the hands of a stranger. Each year in the United States, nearly twice as many people kill themselves as are murdered. Only a small number of the 400,000 suicide attempts in America each year involve guns. But because people who shoot themselves usually kill themselves, gun suicides account for more than half of all completed suicides. When the District of Columbia banned handguns in 1976, civilians were effectively prohibited from buying, selling, transferring, or possessing weapons. The suicide rate in the city of Washington, D.C., fell by 23%. The drop was immediate, and it was entirely because of a reduced number of handgun suicides. The researchers who conducted the study measured suicide rates before and after the handgun ban. They found the suicide reduction was limited to Washington, D.C., where handguns were banned, and was not observed in the suburbs, where no changes were instituted to gun laws. The decline in suicide in Washington, in other words, was not part of a general reduction in suicide risk in the metropolitan area. Suicides in Washington, D.C. that were not gun-related, moreover, did not show a decline after the handgun ban. The entire reduction in suicide was because there were fewer gun suicides. If you looked at a 20-year period, with the gun ban right in the middle of that period, there were more than 31 suicides per year in Washington before the ban, and only 24 suicides per year after the ban. The researchers also found, contra the intuitions of gun enthusiasts, that the band was also associated with a steep decline in the homicide rate. The decline in homicide was also entirely due to a reduction in shooting deaths, and the decline was limited to Washington and not its suburbs. The District of Columbia, by the way, has one of the lowest suicide rates in the country. If you were to cut suicide by a quarter in places such as Alabama, Alaska, Colorado, Montana, Nevada, and New Mexico, which have much higher suicide rates and many more people than Washington, D.C., you could significantly reduce the scale of suicide in the United States. If you were a public health official and someone told you there was a way to curb a malaria epidemic by 23%, you would be ecstatic. But lawmakers usually don't think like public health officials. They trust their intuitions, and their intuitions tell them that owning guns makes people safer. In 2008, led by Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the highest court in the United States reversed the handgun ban in Washington, D.C., on the grounds that it was unconstitutional. "We hold that the district's ban on handgun possession in the home violates the Second Amendment, as does its prohibition against rendering any lawful firearm in the home operable for the purpose of immediate self-defense. The Second Amendment, which guarantees citizens the right to bear arms," Scalia added, "elevates above all other interests the right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home." In a poll published in the Washington Post, 76% of people agreed with the Supreme Court decision. The idea that a gun can protect you is such an intuitively appealing idea. A robber breaks into your home. You grab a gun from your nightstand and shoot the intruder. How many times have we seen movies where brave people stand guard outside their homes, rifles in hand? Advocates for gun ownership are only following their intuitions. The Second Amendment, in fact, enshrines our collective intuition about guns and self-defense into the Constitution. We believe we are safer when we have weapons to defend ourselves. What the framers of the Second Amendment did not foresee is that the long-barreled muskets of the 18th century, which were difficult to use to commit suicide, would one day be replaced by handguns, and the greater threat to the lives of Americans would come not from murderous strangers or an authoritarian government, but from suicide, accidental shootings, and family members using handguns to kill one another. We certainly feel more control when we have a gun in our possession, and it is easy to confuse the feeling of control with safety. Indeed, this is an unconscious bias in the hidden brain. Over millennia, evolution caused animals, including humans, to experience anxiety in situations where they lacked control, because those situations were more dangerous than situations in which the animal did have control. The unconscious rule of thumb that links control with safety breaks down in modern life, however. People feel safer barreling down a highway at 70 miles an hour without seatbelts than they do sitting in a passenger plane going through turbulence. The fact that we are in control of the car gives us the illusion of safety, even though all the empirical evidence shows we are safer in the plane. Suicide rates in states with high levels of gun ownership are much higher than in states that have low levels of gun ownership. Alabama, Idaho, Colorado, Utah, Montana, Wyoming, and New Mexico have twice the rate of suicide of Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Connecticut, Hawaii, and New York. The United States as a whole has a very high suicide rate compared to other industrialized countries. Researchers working for the federal government once examined the suicide rate among children in the United States and 25 other industrialized countries over a single year. The suicide rate among American children was more than twice the average suicide rate among children in the other 25 countries. The homicide rate among children in the United States was 5 times higher. Guns were responsible for much of this. If you measured only gun-related homicide and suicide, American children were 11 times more likely than children in the other 25 countries to commit suicide by shooting themselves, were 9 times more likely to be killed in accidental shootings, and were 16 times more likely to be murdered. There were 1,107 children shot to death in all the countries. 957 of these victims, 86%, were children in the United States. The researchers Arthur Kellerman and Donald Ray once examined all gun-related deaths over a lengthy period of time in King County in the state of Washington. They were trying to find evidence for the common intuition that gun owners are safer because they can protect themselves and their families should someone break into their homes. Kellerman and Ray identified 9 deaths during the period of the study where people shot and killed an intruder. These are the stories that gun advocates endlessly relate to one another. In the same period, guns in people's homes were implicated in 12 accidental deaths and 41 homicides, usually family members shooting one another. The number of suicides? 333. The gun lobby has often questioned the accuracy of these studies and reports. Rather than seek more accurate answers, however, it has leaned on Congress and successive administrations to cut off funding for research into firearm-related violence. After the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention study showing high rates of gun-related suicide and homicide among American children was published, Congress slashed funding for CDC firearm injury research. Much of the suicide and homicide data is years old today because the research has effectively been choked off. Guns do not cause violence, said Kellerman, an Emory University researcher. He is a Southerner who grew up around guns, and he understands and appreciates gun culture. The trigger does not pull the finger. However, guns amplify the consequences of violence, and that amplification might be to an extent you cannot reverse. You can treat an overdose patient and stop the bleeding if they cut themselves, but guns have one of the highest completion rates for suicide. It is heartbreaking. If you visit the website of the National Rifle Association, you will find that it is devoted to the idea that people have a right to defend themselves against criminals. What is never mentioned is the risk that gun owners pose to themselves. When we think about it intuitively, when we let our hidden brain do the thinking for us, the risk of suicide, accidents, and domestic violence feels remote compared to the risk of homicide. If we are smart people, if we are responsible gun owners, if we are not mentally unstable or defective, surely the suicide statistics will not apply to us. That is the way most of the 30,000 people who kill themselves every year in America think too. Stop for a moment and think about that number. More than 10 times the number of Americans who died in the September 11th terrorist attacks kill themselves every year in the United States. It's early 2009 as I write these words. At least 200,000 more Americans have died from suicide than from terrorism since September 10th, 2001. Which would you say poses a greater risk to the average American? If you are taking about 90 seconds to read each page of this book, someone in the United States will likely have committed suicide since you started reading this chapter. If you bought a gun today, I could tell you the risk of suicide to you and your family members is going to be 2 to 10-fold higher over the next 20 years, epidemiologist Matthew Miller at Harvard told me. There are not many things you can do to increase your risk of dying 10-fold. I asked Michelle Shinnick what she made of John Violante's research and his idea that cops should check their guns at the station when they left work. She was silent for a long moment. Then she said she doubted it would work. Ed Shinnick knew and loved guns. He owned 5 weapons. He owned his own service revolver. If departments were to take away the guns of police officers when they left work, Michelle Shinnick said, cops would buy weapons for their personal protection. Do I wish he did not have a gun? She asked. Sure, but I think if he was determined, he would have done it anyway. The empirical research into suicide, however, calls into question the intuitively popular notion that people who are intent on suicide will always find ways to kill themselves. The statistics speak for themselves. About 400,000 people attempt suicide each year in the United States. The vast majority of those who survive do not go on to kill themselves. Suicide is primarily an act of impulse, which is why the suicide rate in Washington, D.C. fell by a quarter when people were restrained from owning handguns. The impulse to end your life rarely spans months and years. It usually lasts hours, maybe a day or two, a week at most. Within that narrow window, people with lethal means at their disposal are at far higher risk than people who lack the vector of destruction. Ed Shinnick was a great example of a stable, responsible, highly trained gun owner. All the weapons in his home were locked, and the guns were always placed in a safe that was also locked. He never drank. He was an upstanding, religious family man. Guns made Ed Shinnick feel safe. He was ready to confront any assassin, except the one in the mirror. This chapter has focused so far on the subject of risk, which is all about small numbers. Our inability to intuitively tell the difference between something that has a 1 in 1,000 chance of occurring and something that has a 1 in 2,000 chance of occurring explains why we make errors in thinking about homicide and suicide. Both risks are rare. They involve tiny numbers. The difference between them is abstract. We do not feel it in our gut. The risk for suicide is twice as large as the risk for homicide in the United States, but it doesn't feel that way. Homicide scares us, and suicide does not. Because in the absence of being able to grasp a concrete difference between a 1 in 1,000 risk and a 1 in 2,000 risk, we fall back on our hidden brains to do our thinking for us. Our unconscious minds are exquisitely tuned to the unexpected, violent attack. We are always on the lookout for strange and exotic threats. In our evolutionary history, this made sense. If a new predator arrived on the scene, or an old predator suddenly came up with a clever new ambush, it required only a single example of the new threat to reshape our behavior. Our brains were designed in the crucible of a violent past, where the greatest threats to our ancestors came from predators, injuries, and traps. This might be why we all have primal fears. The creak on the stair in the middle of the night, the airplane crash, the psychopath loose on the streets. There might well be deep evolutionary reasons for these fears. It made sense, millennia ago, to fear situations where we had no control and situations that involved malevolent attackers. In our modern world, however, the things we really ought to fear are almost entirely of our own doing. Failing to climb the stairs and get enough exercise kills far more people than any number of murderers climbing those stairs. You're at far greater risk of taking your own life than being killed by a terrorist. If you were to go strictly by the numbers, that cigarette in your hand ought to have you screaming louder than a chance encounter with Hannibal Lecter. But we don't go by the numbers, because we are not very good at thinking about the relative sizes of small numbers. Our unconscious minds fall back on intuitions that bias us into fearing the kind of risks that pose the greatest danger to our ancestors, violent external threats. This may be why terrorism, homicide, and airplane crashes scare us more than heart disease, suicide, and lung cancer. Unconscious biases in the hidden brain explain why we fear things that are unlikely and why we are blasé about things that can do us harm. I know this firsthand. My very first front page article as a journalist was about the risks of riding motorcycles without helmets. I have close relatives who have died in traffic accidents. 8 years after that first article, I went on a road trip in India with some friends. On a motorcycle, without a helmet. If you ask me why I did it, I will give you the same answers as thousands of people who do stupid things every day. I don't know. The risk seemed small. All my friends were riding on bikes without helmets. I thought I was a skilled rider. There are an infinite number of ways to rationalize unconscious bias. As I was leaning into a turn at about 40 miles an hour, a patch of gravel came up suddenly. I knew I was in trouble. Time slowed down. I skidded. I will never forget the awful feeling of traveling sideways, my wheels gliding beneath me like skates. I can feel it now. And then, in a moment, it was over. The wheels found traction, I pulled out of the skid, and it was as if nothing had happened. The dumb algorithms in our hidden brain are not programmed to trigger panic when it comes to the risks we pose ourselves, which is why I didn't feel paralyzing fear when I chose to ride a motorbike without a helmet, and why millions of gun owners feel safer with loaded guns on their nightstands. Unconscious bias explains why so many of our fears and national policies are completely detached from reality. 2 years after the September 11th terrorist attacks, a research study found that if Americans who thought they would be personally killed by terrorism were actually killed by terrorists, there would have to be the equivalent of a September 11th scale attack every single day in the United States. Americans did not misperceive the risk of terrorism because they enjoyed scaring themselves. No, the hidden brain biased us into paying exaggerated attention to terrorism because the hidden brain is programmed to be disproportionately vigilant to threats that are new, terrifying, and malevolent. We have carried our Stone Age brain into the Internet Age. It is Stone Age thinking that prompts us to spend so much of our national budget fighting terrorism and so little on the everyday diseases and threats that kill many, many more Americans and that are certain to kill many, many more Americans in the years to come. Small numbers aren't the only challenge that the brain finds difficult to handle. We are not very good with large numbers either. This, too, has extraordinary consequences in the realm of moral judgment. The Insicco, 1907, was a tramp tanker that roamed the Pacific Ocean. Its 12-man Taiwanese crew hunted the seas for fishing fleets in need of fuel. The Insicco had a cargo of tens of thousands of gallons of diesel. It was supposed to be an Indonesian ship, except that it was not registered in Indonesia because its owner, who lived in China, did not bother with taxes. In terms of international law, the Insicco 1907 was stateless, a 260-foot microscopic speck on the largest ocean on Earth. On March 13, 2002, a fire broke out in the Insicco's engine room. It killed a crew member and singed the ship's chief engineer. The fire spread quickly and set aflame some oil in the bilge. The fire moved so fast that crew members did not have time to radio for help. 11 survivors and the captain's puppy, who was along for the voyage, retreated to the tanker's forecastle. They dragged supplies of food and water with them. From their perch, they watched the fire burn for 20 days and 20 nights. The ship was about 800 miles south of Hawaii's Big Island and adrift. Its crew could not call on anyone for help, and no one who could help knew of the Insicco's existence, let alone its problems. Drawn by wind and currents, the Insicco eventually got within 220 miles of Hawaii, where it was spotted by a cruise ship called the Norwegian Star on April 2nd. The cruise ship diverted course, rescued the Taiwanese crew, and radioed the United States Coast Guard. But as the Norwegian Star pulled away from the Insicco and steamed toward Hawaii, a few passengers on the cruise ship heard the sound of barking. The captain's puppy had been left behind on the tanker. It is not entirely clear why the cruise ship did not rescue the Jack Russell mixed terrier, or why the Taiwanese crew did not insist on it. Some accounts suggest that cruise ship officers refused to take the dog because they were concerned they would run afoul of Hawaii's strict animal quarantine laws, and the Taiwanese captain, who had just been through a terrible ordeal, did not put his foot down. There may have been communication problems. Whatever the reason, the burned-out tanker and its lonely inhabitant were abandoned on the terrible immensity of the Pacific. The Norwegian Star made a stop at Maui. A passenger who heard the barking dog called the Hawaiian Humane Society in Honolulu. The animal welfare group routinely rescued abandoned animals. 675 animals were rescued the previous year, but recovering a dog on a tanker adrift in the Pacific was something new. Pamela Burns, president of the Hawaiian Humane Society, was in Florida when she got a call about the dog. She decided the society should look into a rescue. The U.S. Coast Guard said it could not use taxpayer dollars to save the dog. The tanker was in international waters and outside the purview of the United States government. Officials told the Humane Society that rescuing the dog might cost anywhere from $60,000 to $80,000. The Chinese owner of the Insicco was not planning to recover the ship, let alone the dog. The Humane Society alerted fishing boats about the lost tanker. Media reports began appearing about the terrier, whose name was Hoquette. Something about a lost puppy on an abandoned ship on the Pacific gripped people's imaginations. Money poured into the Humane Society to fund a rescue. One check was for $5,000. People got in touch from as far away as New York and even England. In the end, donations came from 39 states, the District of Columbia, and 4 foreign countries. It was just about a dog, Burns told me. It was a fabulous example of how they are our best friend and they deserve good. This was an opportunity for people to feel good about rescuing a dog. People poured out their support. A handful of people were incensed. These people said, "You should be giving money to the homeless." But Burns felt the great thing about America was that people were free to give money to whatever cause they cared about. And people cared about Hoquette. The problem with a rescue was that no one knew where the Insicco was. The Coast Guard estimated it could be anywhere in an area measuring 360,000 square miles. The Humane Society paid $48,000 to a private company called American Marine Corporation to look for the Insicco. 2 Humane Society officers boarded a salvage tugboat, the American Quest, and set off into the Pacific. Air, sea, and high-tech surveillance equipment were all pressed into service. With each passing day, the calls from around the world intensified. Had Hoquette been found? In 6-hour shifts, Humane Society officers and the tugboat crew studied radar screens, hoping to get a glimpse of the tanker. Pressure was mounting on U.S. officials to do something. Under the guise of exercises, the U.S. Navy began quietly hunting for the Insicco. The tramp tanker was deemed a search target for a maintenance and training mission. By April 7th, the expensive search had turned up nothing. The Insicco had either sunk or drifted outside the Coast Guard's search box. The letters and checks continued to pour in. This check is in memory of the little dog lost at sea. Thank you for pulling my heartstrings and for reminding me of all the hope there is left in this world. This story is also great for the children. They learn to respect life. On April 9th, a window of hope opened. A Japanese fishing boat, the Victoria City, told the Coast Guard it had seen something that looked like the Insicco. The Coast Guard relayed the message to the Humane Society, which got word out to fishing fleets in the area to keep an eye out for the tanker. The Insicco had drifted far outside the Coast Guard's projections. It was still in international waters, but far to the west of the search box where rescuers had been hunting. The Inseco seemed roughly headed in the direction of Johnston Atoll, an unincorporated and uninhabited U.S. territory, and the Coast Guard finally decided this was a good enough reason to intervene. The Coast Guard dispatched a C-130 aircraft with a high-tech forward-looking radar. After searching another 50,000 square miles of ocean, the Coast Guard found the Inseco. A photo taken with a telephoto lens showed a brown and white blur running across the deck of the tanker. Hoquette was still alive. The C-130 was not equipped for a rescue, so the crew dropped their own lunches onto the tanker for the dog: pizza, granola bars, and oranges. Media interest in the terrier surged. The captain of the Inseco declared he would love to have his dog back. He said he had picked her up in Indonesia and named her after the Mandarin word for fortune. Two fishing vessels eventually reached the Inseco. For 2 days, fishermen tried to rescue the dog. The puppy took one look at them and fled below decks in the direction of the engine room. The rescuers tried to tempt the terrier with peanut butter. They called out in multiple languages. It wasn't possible to chase Hoquette into the engine room. The fire had rendered much of the Inseco dangerous. It was still carrying thousands of gallons of fuel, and no one knew the extent of the damage. The fishermen eventually gave up and let the Inseco go its aimless way. Rusty Knoll, vice president of American Marine Corporation, the private company contracted by the Humane Society to rescue Hoquette, was in regular touch with Coast Guard officials and fishing fleets. When he heard the dog had not been seen after it ran below decks, his heart sank. The engine room had a 10-foot drop. Had Hoquette been inadvertently injured or killed? Would the long vigil turn out to be futile? Knoll felt like giving up, except that when he went home each night, his 9-year-old daughter, Morgan, would ask, "Did you find the doggy, Daddy?" Knoll would come back to work the next day and press on. There was talk of dispatching the U.S. Navy to sink the Inseco as a way of ensuring that any release of hazardous materials would occur hundreds of miles from shore. This, of course, would kill the dog, assuming it was still alive. Facing intense public pressure to save Hoquette, government officials concluded that asking the U.S. Navy to sink the tanker, 750 miles from Hawaii, nearly 2,500 miles from the U.S. mainland, and drifting away from the United States, posed unacceptable environmental risks. The Coast Guard decided to access U.S. taxpayer funds to recover the Inseco. It wasn't officially called an animal rescue effort. The rescue was authorized under the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund, based on the argument that if the aimless Inseco somehow managed to follow a westward course for 250 straight miles, it might run aground on Johnston Atoll and harm marine life. The environmental concern was a lovely touch, given that the United States used Johnston Atoll for a good part of the 20th century as a nuclear weapons test site and a dumping ground for chemical weapons from various wars. Nerve agents, blister agents, sarin, and plutonium contamination were Johnston Atoll's environmental legacy, but diesel was deemed too deadly. The American Quest tugboat was called up again, this time funded by taxpayers, to rescue Hoquette and bring the Inseco back to Honolulu. Throughout the drama of the previous weeks, the Humane Society had called the dog Forgay, because it had been told the Mandarin name for the dog was Forgay. That was the name that the fishermen had used when they tried to lure the dog with peanut butter. Now the Humane Society learned the dog's name was actually Hoquette, according to the correct pronunciation in the dialect Hokkien, the language of the tanker's captain. Armed with this new information and a dog trap, the American Quest set off. In case the terrier did not come voluntarily, the rescuers also took along treats and a ham bone. On April 26th, nearly 1.5 months after the puppy's ordeal began, the American Quest found the Inseco and boarded the tanker. The 40-pound female pup was still alive and hiding in a pile of tires. It was a hot day, so Brian Murray, the American Quest salvage supervisor, went in and simply grabbed the terrier by the scruff of her neck. The puppy was terrified and shook for 2 hours. Her rescuers fed her, bathed her, and applied lotion to her nose, which was sunburnt. Hoquette arrived in Honolulu on May 2nd, with the Insicko hauled in tow so her diesel could be salvaged, and was greeted by crowds of spectators, a press conference, banners welcoming her to America, and a pretty red Hawaiian lei. A local radio station played "Who Let the Dogs Out?" The local, national, and international media were all in prominent attendance. After serving a period in quarantine, Hoquette was adopted by the family of Michael Kuo of Honolulu. She put on weight and was signed up for dog classes. The story of Hoquette's rescue is comical, but it is also touching. Human beings from around the world came together to save a dog. The vast majority of people who sent money to the Humane Society knew they would never personally see Hoquette, never have their hands licked in gratitude. Saving the dog, as Pamela Burns suggested to me, was an act of pure altruism and a marker of the remarkable capacity human beings have to empathize with the plight of others. There are a series of disturbing questions, however. 8 years before Hoquette was rescued, the same world that showed extraordinary compassion in the rescue of a dog sat on its hands as 1 million human beings were killed in Rwanda. Shortly after the dog rescue, as a genocide in Darfur unfolded with terrible accounts of mass rape and murder, ABC News devoted 18 minutes over the entire course of 2004 to tell Americans in nightly newscasts what was happening. ABC, by the way, led the way among the major networks. NBC devoted 5 minutes and CBS 3 minutes in 2004 to Darfur. The 20th century reveals a shockingly long list of similar horrors that have been ignored by the world as they unfolded. 2 million Armenians in 1915, 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. John Prendergast of the Enough Project, an advocacy group committed to ending genocide, told me that more than 5 million people have died as a result of war, famine, and disease in the Congo over the past decade. Why have successive generations of Americans, a people with extraordinary powers of compassion, done so little to halt suffering on such a large scale? Why have successive American presidents placed genocide so low on their list of priorities? It isn't because of a lack of awareness. When President George W. Bush was sworn into office in January 2001, the first words he heard as president were about an unfolding crisis in southern Sudan, where more than 2 million people eventually died. The Reverend Franklin Graham, who was leading a prayer at the Bush inauguration, whispered, "Mr. President, I hope you do something about southern Sudan." There are many explanations for the discrepancy between our response to Hoquette and our response to genocide. Some argue that Americans care little about foreign lives, but then what should we make about their willingness to spend thousands of dollars to rescue a dog, a foreign dog, on a stateless ship in international waters? Well, perhaps Americans care more about pets than people. But that does not stand up to scrutiny either. Hoquette's rescue was remarkable, but there are countless stories about similar acts of compassion and generosity that people show toward their fellow human beings every day. No, there is something about genocide, about mass death in particular, that seems to trigger inaction. I believe our inability to wrap our minds around large numbers is responsible for our apathy toward mass suffering. We are unconsciously biased in our moral judgment, in much the same way we are biased when we think about risk. Just as we are blasé about heart disease and lackadaisical about suicide, but terrified about psychopaths and terrorists, so also we make systematic errors in thinking about moral questions, especially those involving large numbers of people. The philosopher Peter Singer once devised a dilemma that highlights a central contradiction in our moral reasoning. If you see a child drowning in a pond, and you know you can save the child without any risk to your own life, but you would ruin a fine pair of shoes worth $200 if you jumped into the water, would you save the child or save your shoes? Most people react incredulously to the question. Obviously, a child's life is worth more than a pair of shoes. If this is the case, Singer asked, why do large numbers of people hesitate to write a check for $200 to a reputable charity that could save the life of a child halfway around the world, when there are millions of such children who need our help? Even when people are absolutely certain their money will not be wasted and will be used to save a child's life, fewer people are willing to write the check than to leap into the pond. Our moral responsibilities feel different in these situations, even though Singer is absolutely right in arguing they are equivalent challenges. One feels immediate and visceral, the other distant and abstract. We feel personally responsible for one child, whereas the other is one of millions who need help. Our responsibility feels diffused when it comes to children in distant places. There are many people who could write that check. But distance and diffusion of responsibility do not explain why we step forward in some cases. Why did so many people come forward to save Hoquette? Why did they write checks for a dog they would never meet? Why did they feel a single abandoned dog on a stateless ship was their problem? I want to offer a disturbing idea. The reason human beings seem to care so little about mass suffering and death is precisely because the suffering is happening on a mass scale. The brain is simply not very good at grasping the implications of mass suffering. Americans would be far more likely to step forward if only a few people were suffering or a single person were in pain. Hoquette did not draw our sympathies because we care more about dogs than people. She drew our sympathies because she was a single dog lost on the biggest ocean in the world. If the hidden brain biases our perceptions about risk toward exotic threats, it shapes our compassion into a telescope. We are best able to respond when we are focused on a single victim. We don't feel 20 times sadder when we hear that 20 people have died in a disaster than when we hear that one person has died, even though the magnitude of the tragedy is 20 times larger. We feel outrage at a murderer who kills someone, but we don't feel 10 times the outrage if the murderer turns out to be a serial killer. We certainly don't feel 100 times the outrage if he turns out to be a mass-murdering psychopath who kills 100 people. We do not viscerally feel that a Hitler, who is responsible for the deaths of millions, is millions of times worse than the murderer who kills one person. We can certainly reach such a conclusion abstractly in our conscious minds, but we cannot feel it viscerally, because that is the domain of the hidden brain, and the hidden brain is simply not calibrated to deal with the difference between a single death and a million deaths. But the paradox does not end there. Even if 10 deaths do not make us feel 10 times as sad as a single death, shouldn't we feel 5 times as sad, or even at least twice as sad? There is disturbing evidence that shows that in many situations, not only do we not care twice as much about 10 deaths as we do about one, but we may actually care less. I strongly suspect that if the Insicko had been carrying 100 dogs, many people would have cared less about their fate than they did about Hoquette. 100 dogs do not have a single face, a single name, a single life story around which we can wrap our imaginations and our compassion. I found it ironic when Pamela Burns of the Hawaiian Humane Society told me that the thing she could not understand is how people spend $50,000 getting a kidney transplant for their cat when hundreds of healthy animals at shelters around the country are being euthanized. But when you consider the problem we have with large numbers, this makes sense. We spend our money to save one life and not 10 lives or 100, because our internal telescope unconsciously biases us to care more about one life than 100. The evidence for what I am going to call the telescope effect comes from a series of fascinating experiments. At the University of Oregon, the psychologist Paul Slovic asked volunteers shortly after the Rwandan genocide to imagine they were officials in charge of a humanitarian rescue effort. They could spend their money saving 4,500 lives at a refugee camp, but there were also many other pressing needs for the money. Without the volunteers being aware of it, Slovic divided them into two groups. Both groups were told their money could save 4,500 lives, but one group was told the refugee camp had 11,000 people, whereas the other group was told the refugee camp had 100,000 people. Slovic found that people were much more reluctant to spend the money on the large camp than they were to spend the money on the small camp. Intrigued, Slovic pressed further. He asked different groups of volunteers to imagine they were running a philanthropic foundation. Would they rather spend $10 million to save 10,000 lives from a disease that caused 15,000 deaths a year, or save 20,000 lives from a disease that killed 290,000 people a year? Overwhelmingly, volunteers preferred to spend money saving the 10,000 lives rather than the 20,000 lives. Rather than tailor their investments to saving the largest number of lives, people sought to save the largest proportion of lives among the different groups of victims. An investment directed toward disease A could save two-thirds of the victims, whereas an investment directed at disease B could save only 7% of the victims. We respond to mass suffering in much the same way we respond to most things in our lives. We fall back on rules of thumb, on feelings, on intuitions. People who choose to spend money saving 10,000 lives rather than 20,000 lives are not bad people. Rather, like those who spend thousands of dollars rescuing a single dog rather than directing the same amount of money to save a dozen dogs, they are merely allowing their hidden brain to guide them. I have often wondered why the hidden brain displays a telescope effect when it comes to compassion. Evolutionary psychology tends to be an armchair sport, so please take my explanation for the paradox as one of several possible answers. The telescope effect may have arisen because evolution has built a powerful bias into us to preferentially love our kith and kin. It is absurd that we spend $200 on a birthday party for our son or our daughter when we could send the same money to a charity and save the life of a child halfway around the world. How can one child's birthday party mean more to us than another child's life? When we put it into those terms, we sound like terrible human beings. The paradox, as with the rescue of Hoket, is that our impulse springs from love, not callousness. Evolution has built a fierce loyalty toward our children into the deepest strands of our psyche. Without the unthinking telescope effect in the unconscious mind, parents would not devote the immense time and effort it takes to raise children. Generations of our ancestors would not have braved danger and cold, predators and hunger, to protect their young. The fact that you and I exist testifies to the utility of having a telescope in the brain that caused our ancestors to care intensely about the good of the few rather than the good of the many. This telescope is activated when we hear a single cry for help, the child drowning in the pond, the puppy abandoned on an ocean. When we think of human suffering on a mass scale, our telescope does not work, because it has not been designed to work in such situations. What makes evolutionary sense rarely makes moral sense. One paradox of evolution is that ruthless natural selection has produced a species that recoils at the ruthlessness of natural selection. Humans are the first and only species that is even aware of large-scale suffering taking place in distant lands. The moral telescope in our brain has not had a chance to evolve and catch up with our technological advances. When we are told about a faraway genocide, we can apply only our conscious mind to the challenge. We can reason, but we cannot feel the visceral compassion that is automatically triggered by the child who is drowning right before us. Our conscious minds can tell us that it is absurd to spend a boatload of money to save one life, when the same money could be used to save 10. Just as it can tell us it is absurd to be more worried about homicide than suicide. But in moral decision-making, as in many other domains of life where we are unaware of how unconscious biases influence us, it is the hidden brain that usually carries the day. Slovic once told volunteers about a 7-year-old girl in Mali who was starving and in desperate need of help. Volunteers in the experiment were given a certain amount of money and asked how much they were willing to spend to help the little girl. On average, people gave half their money to help the girl. Slovic then asked another group of volunteers the same question, except instead of the little girl, the volunteers were told about the problem of famine in Africa and that there were millions of people in dire need of help. The volunteers gave half as much money as the volunteers in the first group. In another study in Israel, Slovic and his colleagues found that people were willing to donate more money to help save the life of a single child with cancer than they were to help 8 children with cancer. Slovic took the experiment that showcased the little girl in Africa a step further. He told another group of volunteers about a little boy in Mali. One group of volunteers was asked whether they would give money to the little girl. Another was asked whether they would donate money to the little boy. A third group of volunteers was told about both the boy and the girl and asked how much they were willing to give. People gave the same amount of money when told about either the boy or the girl, but when the children were presented together, the volunteers gave less. Journalists sometimes talk about compassion fatigue, the inability of people to respond to suffering when the scale or length of the suffering exceeds some astronomical number. But Slovic's work suggests that compassion fatigue starts when the number of victims in need of help rises from 1 to 2. The feelings of sadness dropped, Slovic said about the volunteers who were told about the 2 children in need of help. He added, "You can't lock onto 2 people in need of help as closely as you can lock onto 1 person. You can't make an emotional connection as strongly to 2 as to 1. If empathy is putting yourself in someone else's shoes, think of putting yourself in 2 people's shoes. It does not work. It falls apart." When we rely on the hidden brain to guide our moral decision-making, we spend millions on dramatic rescues of a few lives and spend next to nothing on saving the lives of millions. There is no use complaining about the hidden brain or wishing it away. The telescope effect in our moral judgment is part of our nature. There is nothing we can do about it. But there is something we can do about our actions. We can choose to allow our actions to be guided by reason rather than instinct, choose to set up national and international institutions that respond instantly to humanitarian crises, rather than wait for our heartstrings to be pulled by stories of individual tragedy. If we rely on our moral telescopes, there will be people in 100 years who ask how the world could have sat on its hands through so many genocides in the 21st century. Making the unconscious conscious is difficult because a central obstacle lies within ourselves. But putting reason ahead of instinct and intuition is also what sets us apart from every other species that has ever lived. Understanding the hidden brain and building safeguards to protect us against its vagaries can help us be more successful in our everyday lives. It can aid us in our battle against threats and help us spend our money more wisely. But it can also do something more important than any of those things. It can make us better people. For all the ways this book has shown how the rational mind is unequal to the machinations of the hidden brain, this is also a book that argues that reason is our only bulwark against bias. Our hidden brain will always make some criminals seem more dangerous, and some presidential candidates seem less trustworthy because of the color of their skin. Terrorism, psychopaths, and homicide will always seem scarier to us than obesity, smoking, and suicide. The heartbreaking story about the single puppy lost at sea will make us cry more quickly than a dry account of a million children killed by malaria. In every one of these cases, reason is our only rock against the tides of unconscious bias. It is our lighthouse and our life jacket. It is, or should be, our voice of conscience. This is Steve West. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives, by Shunkar Vithantham. This program was directed by Tony Hutz. Executive producers, Dan Musselman and Dan Zitt. Text copyright 2010 by Shunkar Vithantham. Production copyright 2010, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.